Good evening, and thanks for coming out to the last of this year's medical ethics, medical halacha sessions. Our topic has been advertised in various ways, depending on which flyer or listing you looked at, but they all come down to the same point, which is rationing end-of-life care, and stems from the case of Hassan Rasuli at Sunnybrook Hospital, but really it's broader, and you can bring other cases which have come to the fore since then. But I'm going to go over the details of the Rasuli case briefly, because that's really what gave me the impetus for this conversation. In 2010, Hassan Rasuli was admitted to Sunnybrook Hospital for neurosurgery to remove a benign tumor, a brain tumor. He contracted a severe infection, which damaged his brain and left him in a persistent vegetative state. Sunnybrook Hospital believed that Rasuli had no hope of recovery. They wanted to withdraw life support, contending that what they were giving him no longer constituted medical care, so they should be able to take it away. The Rasuli family argued that withdrawing care is itself an act of care, and therefore consent is required. So not only do you need consent in order to give a medication, to engage in a therapy, but you also need consent in order to withdraw that treatment. Now, after a series of court battles and appeals, the Supreme Court of Canada agreed with the claim that withdrawing care is also an act of care, and therefore consent is required. The hospital can go to the consent and capacity board if they don't like the family's decision, but they cannot unilaterally withdraw life support. It was a very interesting decision. Last year, in June of 2014, I was invited to take part in a panel discussion on behalf of B'nai B'rith on the topic of the Rasuli case, and they actually had lawyers from both sides present at the and sitting on the panel together. And it was very interesting to hear them discuss this, because the lawyer on behalf of the Rasuli family said he was living in fear the entire time that the hospital was going to change its argument. The hospital could easily have won if they would have agreed that withdrawing care is an act of care, and therefore it said, we're going to go to the consent and capacity board. Normally, if doctors feel that a certain path of treatment is correct, and they feel that the substitute decision maker is not acting in the best interests of the patient, they have the ability to go to the consent and capacity board and get their opinion. And had they done so, said the lawyer, they likely would have won, and Sunnybrook would have been able to remove care. However, because they didn't go that route, and instead they tried to set precedent in the courts to say that we don't even need the consent and capacity board, we can withdraw care all on our own, because they made that that argument, they ended up losing because the court didn't accept it. Do you follow? It was a very interesting discussion between the lawyers, as one is telling the other, boy, you could have had me if only you had taken a different approach. Interestingly, in 2013, Hassan Rasuli's condition was upgraded to minimally conscious. He has since left Sunnybrook, and he's now at a healthcare facility which is able to support his care. So, in that B'nai B'rith program that we had about the case last year, my role in it was to present a Jewish ethical perspective on the following question. Is money the elephant in the room? Is that really what this debate is about? In other words, when the hospital says, we want to stop providing care, is it because they believe that that's what the patient should have, that you should actually cut off the care, and ethically that's what's driving them? Is it because they have limited resources? Is it because they don't want to spend on keeping this person in a state that they don't consider life? That was the question that I was asked. So I'll turn around and ask you the question. What do you think? Is money the elephant in the room in this conversation? I see a head nod of yes. Should it be, but is it?
Could be.
Could be.
You've got 5 other patients waiting to take for that, or mistaken and curable. it's not just money. I mean, unless you could have a, you are worried that you don't have the money to build another ICU or whatever.
Right.
It seems that you've got limited resources. Money isn't the issue. It's utilization of resources effectively.
Right, and the issues of money and how many people can I save are fundamentally linked. Right, that was what you were going to say also.
Yeah, you know, it's not cash for the hospital because the hospital is on a global budget.
Right.
So it's the hospital is not going to make any more or less money that's directly related to the decision on one
right.
patient.
No, it's the system.
It's the system. It's the limited resource of the entire system.
Right. And to me, really, it does all come down to resources, which has these two arms to it, one being the money arm and the other being how many people can we save. The cases that we're talking about are cases where the medical practitioners believe that there is no reasonable hope that the patient's condition is going to improve, but the patient is not in pain, the patient is not suffering. The question is simply, do we continue this state as long as we are technologically capable? I know that urn back there is making some kind of weird noise. I'm hoping that it's not in danger. If anyone is disturbed by it back there, you can always move up. But I hear it. Okay. So I brought you a few papers here. I brought you a few papers here on the sheet. Oh, no. I can't believe I just permitted you to pull the plug. We don't need the rest of the sheer. Okay. That's one. They wanted to do that because they felt that it was the noise from his life support was disturbing people in the unit. You know what, though? It's still going. That's weird. Okay. I don't know. It's something else. In any case, take a look, please, at source number one on your sheets. All three of these papers are European papers. They're not dealing with North America. Nonetheless, I think their points translate. The first paper, Claire Clark, this is from Britain. Insufficient funding to meet the escalating costs of healthcare has resulted in a scarcity of certain life-sustaining resources. Some form of rationing appears inevitable, and the use of biological age has been advocated as a criterion for rationing these limited resources. People reach a certain age, that's it, they're no longer entitled. I think even the people who are in favor of rationing get squeamish when you talk about a cutoff age.
It's in 2001, though.
Yeah.
Britain has really rescinded a lot of that. You couldn't be dialyzed if you were over 65 then.
Really?
Yeah. Now
wow.
They've changed that.
I'm glad to hear that. The person having to make the decision celebrate a 65th birthday anytime between then and now? Yeah. If you take a look at the second one, the second one is an Italian article. Economists, managers, and health policy makers think that it is wrong, even unethical, not to consider that resources are limited. Ignoring the problem is unethical. If these are inefficiently allocated, they can impede other treatments with higher benefits in terms of health and life saved / cost ratio. So if you're not going to make sure that you're allocating efficiently, what you're doing is cheating people who you could have saved had you allocated more efficiently. It's the flip side of the argument, but once again, it's about resources. And then a third example, this is from a study, even though it's the Indian Journal of Critical Care Medicine, it was actually from France, the study they're referring to. Over the last 15 years, the management of critically ill cancer patients requiring intensive care unit admission has substantially changed. High mortality rates were reported 10 to 20 years ago in cancer patients requiring life-sustaining treatments. Because of these high mortality rates, the high costs, and the moral burden for patients and their families, ICU admission of cancer patients became controversial or even clearly discouraged by some. As a result, the reluctance of intensivists regarding cancer patients has led to frequent refusal of admission in the ICU. They'll be turned away because the prognosis isn't great, because we're going to use the equipment for other people, the high costs that are involved. They actually didn't mention using the equipment for other people. I don't see that in this source. But once again, an issue of cost, an issue of using the resources for people when the decision makers feel it's not really to the advantage of the system. And then the last source that I bring is Canadian, from a document called the CanMeds Framework, which speaks to different expectations for physicians. The CanMeds Physician Competency Framework describes the knowledge, skills, and abilities that specialist physicians need for better patient outcomes. As health advocates, physicians responsibly use their expertise and influence to advance the health and well-being of individual patients, communities, and populations. And then it says, physicians are able to, and there's a list of what physicians should be able to do in this regard, and one of them is appreciate the possibility of conflict inherent in their role as a health advocate for a patient or community with that of manager or gatekeeper. It is important for the physician to recognize that because they are expected to serve as gatekeeper for the system, that will put them, to a certain extent, in a position in which they cannot honestly also argue on behalf of the patient. Even though we would like to believe that a person can juggle both sides and represent both sides adequately at the same time, the reality is that that's really hard to do. Right? If you think back to when you were a child, or maybe not when you were a child, and you had nobody around to play the board game with you, and so you played all the different sides, and you said, I'm going to do what's best for each side within the game, yeah, that doesn't exactly work. And the same thing is true when you're dealing with much higher stakes. When you're asking them to think, on the one hand, about the need of the system to not use the resources for just everybody, but to think about who you can help most and who you can help best, and then, on the other hand, to argue on behalf of the patient and the patient's needs, it really is an unfair position in which to put the physician. So that everybody here, whether you deal with the European sources or the Canadian source, recognizes that what we are dealing with is a problem of limited resources, whether we call it money, whether we call it how many lives can we save, it's really all the same question. And so what I want to ask, from a Jewish medical ethics perspective, is what would Judaism recommend in practice? If you have a Jewish system in which you have limited medical resources, what will we say in terms of treating the population? So that's my question to you. Is there room to argue that Judaism would accept a rationing of life-sustaining care due to cost concerns? That's the question. Sure.
There's, time immemorial, physicians have done this, of rationing. All the wars, I mean, Israeli wars, I'm sure they triage there too. Doctors make a decision. You see 10 patients sitting there, and you choose the ones that you think you can help first and work on them. The ones that aren't critical go off to the side. The ones that are critical, you take the ones that are still, they have a half a chance of living. And that's where you ration your resources. I mean, Israel does it, in the field. And, I mean, if you're looking at triage, you see how they triage all the time.
Well, certainly triage is done. I'm not sure I would equate that, though, with a planned policy for a society.
No, it's not planned, but that's what they could do under the circumstances.
Right, but that's exactly the point. In other words, maybe my obligation is to say, let's put more funds into this, and therefore we're going to be able to use it for a larger population. Or maybe my responsibility is to do triage in a very, we would think of as a poor way, but to say, first come, first serve. Put them in, they use up the equipment, the next person's going to have to wait, and hopefully they survive long enough to get to use it. Maybe that's the system we're being asked to use. Jeff?
Arguably, when you triage people, you, depending on the circumstances, you might take the sickest ones first. And what you're talking about is perhaps denying some people care altogether because you just can't afford to look after everybody to the extent that the sickest ones may need to be looked after.
Right.
So it's somewhat the exact opposite.
Right. So the question really is, what will Judaism say? To which I would say the answer is going to be a little bit surprising. I believe that Judaism does believe in the idea of indeed rationing, and not going based on a first-come, first-served basis necessarily. And my basis for saying this is that the issue is not new. Even though, you know, the ventilator, let's say, is new. But the problem of rationing community resources when it comes to taking care of the needs of the community is very, very old. And I'll give you an example from a couple of thousand years ago during the time when the Jews lived within the Roman Empire. Going back to Talmudic times, there was a practice of roving groups of bandits, kidnapping people, and selling them as slaves. But they gave the Jewish community an opportunity. They said, look, we're going to kidnap these Jews. We're going to sell them as slaves. However, you can outbid the market, so to speak. It requires a certain amount of effort for us to bring them to market. If you will ransom them, then we'll free them. That's the opportunity given to the Jewish community. Well, you can easily see that a community can entirely exhaust its resources trying to free the people who have been taken captive. Not only that, what's going to happen the first time that you pay such a ransom? They'll do it again, right? We've lived through this in our own age. So the question is, what do you do knowing that there is a potentially unlimited demand on the resources you have, the money you have, for ransoming the captives? Take a look, please, at source number 5. Mishnah in the volume called Gittin. Ein poden es hashvuyim yoser al kidei d'mehen mipnei tikkun ha'olam. The Mishnah, a core text of the Talmud going back, as I said, over 2,000 years, says we do not redeem captives for more than their market value. And we say market value means more than what their captors would get for them on the slave market. You're not allowed to bid higher, so to speak. Why? Mipnei tikkun ha'olam. For the sake of repair of the world, by which we mean we don't want to overtax the community. However, the Talmud discusses this and asks, what exactly do you mean by that? Ibayalahu, the Gemara asks, still in source number 5. Hai mipnei tikkun ha'olam. When you say tikkun ha'olam, communal welfare, mishum duchka ditziburahu, odilma mishum do'oligrifu v'laisutfei. Are you saying it's because of communal strain? It puts too much of a demand on the community, meaning that if they demand $1 million for us to ransom this person, we're going to have to then collect $1 million, an awful lot of money for us to collect. Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying that the concern is that they're going to capture more people in the future? What's the difference between the two justifications? What's the practical difference between the two justifications? Or the two explanations, I should say. Yes?
One is immediate and clear.
Right. One is immediate and clear, and the other is concerned for the future. Good. Give me a practical case in which, according to one argument, I would say ransom, and according to the other argument, I would say don't ransom. So the Talmud gives a practical case. What if I am personally wealthy enough to be able to ransom the individual? And the individual is close to me. The Talmud gives a case involving a man by the name of Levi, son of Darga, who was wealthy, and his daughter was taken captive. And he said, I'm going to ransom her myself. And he pays a huge sum of money, 13,000 gold dinar. The number 13,000, often when it appears in the Talmud, simply means a really, really large sum, as Tosfos notes. But the point is, he pays an outsized sum to ransom her. And so the sages say, well, if your rationale was to avoid overtaxing the community didn't have to pay a dime. He took care of the ransom. But if your rationale is you don't want to encourage them to take more captives in the future, then they are going to be encouraged. They're just going to pick the right ones. they're going to take more captives in the future because it paid off. So which is it? And does Levi Bar Darga doing this demonstrate that it's okay? That in fact we say the rationale is not to overtax the community, and if you're going to do it personally, it's fine. To which the Talmud says, no, you can't bring any proofs from that case, because who says he asked anybody's opinion before he did it? It was his daughter. It could be that he went and asked, what should I do? And they said, don't do it. And he said, thanks, have a nice day. We can't bring any proofs from the case of Levi Bar Darga. But the point is that you see here in the Talmud a discussion, in fact, about rationing and saying we are not going to use more than a certain amount per person. Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport, in an article in the journal Asya in 1990, notes that this has applications as well in terms of tzedakah. He argues, and I brought you the source in number 6, but I'm not going to view it inside. You can take a look at it inside. He argues that the obligation for an individual when it comes to tzedakah is what we call de machsoro, which means you have to pay whatever a person is lacking from whatever his normal standard of living was, which could be, you know, a very large sum of money. However, the responsibility for the community is to pay food, clothing, and burial, a fixed amount in terms of communal funds. And so Rabbi Rappaport argues the open-ended one is the individual's obligation. When it comes to the community, it's a very specific, limited obligation because we ration the community's resources. In terms of evaluating application of resources, I should note, though, that let me say it this way. We've demonstrated that the Talmud has a concept of rationing resources. That part is clear? Are we clear with that? If not, then we should know that now. So we do ration. The question then is, if you're saying that we ration resources, do we distinguish between one health benefit and another health benefit? If I have somebody who I can keep alive for another week, and I have somebody else who I can keep alive long enough to actually cure their disease, and then they're going to live another 20, 30 years, all other things being equal, do we recognize a difference between the person who has 1 week and the person who has 20 or 30 years? What would you say? Sorry?
Ask King Solomon.
Well, these are practical questions.
Does it matter which intervention is more expensive?
Let's say it's the same intervention, but I have two patients in front of me. It's the triage case on the battlefield or the ER, it doesn't make a difference. But I have two people in front of me, and I could use the equipment for one of them, but I can't use the same equipment for both. And I know one of them is somebody I can assess and say, maybe the ER is not the best example, because you can't assess, I don't know. But the point is, my judgment is, this person, I'm just prolonging the inevitable. This person, I can actually cure. Do I make any distinction? Alana?
Well, isn't there a difference between Hayesha and Hayeola? Like, wouldn't the one who's likely to die sooner be sort of put in a slightly different category than someone who lived for hundreds of years?
So that's precisely the question. Would I distinguish between what Alana correctly calls Hayesha and Hayeolam, temporary life versus, so to speak, eternal life? I mean, there ain't no such thing as eternal life within what we're going to provide them. But you know what we're saying. So that's exactly the question. I mean, when we look at the laws of Shabbos, we say that one should violate Shabbos to save somebody, even if the best you can do is extend their life by minutes. It doesn't matter. We still violate Shabbos for them. And that would seem to say that we equate temporary and extended life and say there is no difference. Sure. Correct.
This sounds like,
what do you mean?
Well, if you've limited stuff as a community, you only need to provide X, Y, and Z,
mm-hmm.
then you have to take into account there's two people. That's more than a communal level.
Right, so if we're going to look at the community's responsibility as limited, so maybe then we'll say this is a basis for limitation. Possible. In fact, we have limitations even on the individual level. Take a look at source number 7, please. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, in his Mishnah Berurah, writing in the beginning of the 20th century, is describing the laws for pulling somebody from a fire. What do you do in terms of saving lives from a fire? And he says, two people are in front of you in the flames, bari umesukan. You have one person who is healthy, other than the fact that, you know, he's in the fire. And you have somebody else who appears to be dying. He says, if you could only choose one, bari kodem. The healthy person comes first. In other words, even though we value all life, nonetheless, we give priority to the person who has the possibility of living longer. And this comes up in other areas as well. Take a look, please, at source number 8, a ruling by Moshe Feinstein, dealing with the question of whether somebody would be justified in opting for a surgery which risks short-term life for the sake of gaining long-term life. Right? I mean, we're familiar with such cases. Someone is suffering from a cancer which doctors project will take their lives within a certain period of time. There's a risky experimental surgery they could engage in which could either end their lives now or could give them a much longer prognosis. So are they entitled to risk short-term for the sake of long-term? Take a look at Rabbi Feinstein in source number 8. Regarding surgeries which involve potential danger, and the doubt or the chance of healing is less than 50%. But without the surgery, we know this person is certainly going to die in short order. And you know, you never know, and certainly just means the best assessment we have. He says, I have agreed to permit such surgeries. Hatam, the reason being, because fundamentally the whole discussion hinges on how I view the temporary life that we are risking by engaging in this surgery. He says, "Very mafurish b'avodah zarah dachav zayin v'adai meis misrapin mehen l'chayei shal lo chayshinan." He says, and it's an explicit passage in the Talmud. The Talmud is dealing with the reality of Roman times, in which there was a concern about going to Roman physicians. The concern was, you put yourself in his hands, the Jews not being exactly beloved to the Romans, he, when you're vulnerable, could do something to you to actually end your life sooner, and he would get away with it. No one would ever know the difference. So because of that, the rule was, don't go to Roman doctors. However, the Talmud says, if a person knows he's definitely dying anyway, and again, definitely is an odd word to use, nonetheless, if a person's prognosis is he's going to die soon anyway, then he can go to the Roman. Why? Because he's only risking short-term life anyway. That's the passage in the Talmud, which Rabbi Feinstein quotes here, demonstrating that we do distinguish between the value of temporary life and prolonged life. And Rabbi Feinstein says it most clearly in source number 9, regarding the issue of triage. And this is a very important response that he offers. We're going to see it in a couple of different ways. But take a look at the piece that's here. He says, "Ubidvar shnei cholim," regarding two patients, you have one patient who, based on the assessment of the doctors, he's only going to be healed temporarily to extend his life for whatever, you know, term he can. You have one patient for whom the best you can do is extend his life by another day or two, let's say. And sometimes you can't even extend his life at all. All you're doing is eliminating his pain. But this patient needs immediate care. If you don't take care of them now, they're not even going to have that. They're not even going to have the minimal extension and alleviation. And then the second one, based on the doctor's assessment, they can heal that person entirely. But it's not so clear that this patient actually needs the immediate emergency room care. Notice in parentheses, that's how you write emergency room, if you want to use Hebrew letters. I saw people looking at it, trying to figure it out. I'll help you out there. You only have one bed in the unit. So this is more complicated than the case we've been giving. This isn't just a question of, I have one resource, do I use it for long-term for this one or short-term for that one? It's more complicated. The long-term one may not need it right now. If I give it to him and he didn't really need it, then I unnecessarily ended the life of the short-term one. On the other hand, if I give it to the short-term one, maybe the long-term one really did need it, and then I'm going to end his life. So what do I do? So Rabbi Feinstein, who is the King Solomon of these sorts of issues in the latter half of the 20th century, says, Nira Lefianius Daiti, it appears in my humble opinion, Shimbo Shnehem Bevas Achas, if they come to the unit at the same time, Hainu, Kodem Sheikh Nisu Ha'echad Mehem, meaning they haven't yet brought either of them in, Tsarich Lachnis Betchila as Misha Adas Harofim Anim Tzim Shamich Olim Larap Oso. He says, you take the one you think you can actually cure, and even if you're not sure that they need the care right away, if you think that that's likely, or that that's a possibility, actually, he says, even if you just think it's a possibility that you'd have to start treatment immediately, that's the one you treat. So based on what we've seen, in the Mishnah Berurah regarding the fire, in Rabbi Feinstein regarding surgeries which endanger temporary life in order to possibly gain long-term life, and Rabbi Feinstein here in terms of triage in the ER, the statement seems to be that yes, we value long-term life more than short-term life, and therefore I would then say we have a basis for triage, just like they did with the resources when it came to ransoming captives. So far, so good? Alana?
The next step, though, is assuming that you can choose one over the other.
Yeah.
What happens when somebody is already on the medication and they're not ready?
That's where we're going. Good question. Hang in there. So let me move to the next piece of this. Mincha here is what time? It's 8:45, right? 8:40. Okay. Plenty of time. Let's move to the next phase, because you're right. That's what we have to ask about. I believe that there are three reasons why rationing might be considered problematic, despite what we have said so far. If you haven't yet signed in, please make sure to sign in. The sign-in sheets are where? Okay, I like to be able to follow up afterwards, so please make sure that you're signed in. So point number one of the three. It's true that we value long-term life over short-term life. However, there is an imperative to provide care, even if it's not what we would call an act of healing. In other words, even if you're going to say that extending the person's life by an hour is not the same thing as curing them of disease, it absolutely has value within Jewish law. Whether that is because you're fulfilling the mitzvah of Hashavat Avedah, restoring that which he has lost, that health for that hour, whether it's because of the mitzvah of Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa, do not stand by while somebody's blood is shed, whether it's Ve'ahavta Re'echa Kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, the imperative to heal is still there, and it is still valued. Source number 10, the source I was talking about before when I was talking about violating Shabbos, that's number 10. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says when you're digging through a building that has collapsed on Shabbos, violating Shabbos in order to dig through, afilu mitza'uhu mirutzatz, even if they find this person crushed, she'eno yachol lichyos el lafi sha'ah, such that he could only live short term, mefakhin ubodkin, they overturn the pile of stones and they check for life. Even though this person is not going to live beyond the short term, nonetheless, we will continue to violate Shabbos, overturning the stones to try to check how this person is and potentially mitigate to whatever extent we're able to mitigate. Or if you take a look at source number 11, this is my favorite source on the topic. It's a little bit gruesome, but it says what needs to be said in terms of the way we look at temporary life. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Ha'inyan shel chayim ein lanu shum kinei midah, kama limdod es yogram v'chashivusam, afilu lo b'taro mitzvos. He says, when it comes to life, we don't have a measuring stick for it to gauge just how valuable and important it is, even the question of, well, can he perform mitzvot? Can he learn Torah? Is an irrelevant question. How do I know that, he says? He says, we would desecrate Shabbos for an elderly, ill person who was ridden with boils and is completely incompetent. He is deaf and he's mute and he's insane. He can't do any mitzvah. His family is suffering from his prolonged existence. He keeps them from involvement in Torah and mitzvah because they're taking care of him. And in addition to that, they are deteriorating. Doesn't matter, he says. However, he then goes on to note, if someone is suffering and for them death would be better than life, it is logical to say there's no obligation to intervene. He isn't saying that there's no point when we stop treating somebody. There are points when we stop treating somebody. But his point is to say that we don't put a number on the value of life. That's what he's trying to get at here.
Last two sources, I don't think they proved really, about preferences or triaging as much as that we preserve life at all costs. As long as there's a life, we preserve it at all costs. But within this quote, it raises something that I was thinking about before, but I didn't say it. But can we assess somebody morally and ethically? In other words, if they're a bad person. If the people that you have to decide whether or not to treat, one of them is Stalin and the other one is, a regular person, and Stalin is going to live for another 20 years and the child is going to live for an hour, or, any kind of permutation of that kind of ethical, can we assess it on that? Or
right.
That?
So the answer is maybe. A firm maybe. The question is, can you, assess and decide to treat based on the relative religious value or moral value of the people who you have in front of you? So I think, I don't remember for sure now, but we set the list of topics for next year, and I think one of the topics that I have on there is treating terrorists. So we will have to answer this question in some measure, but in terms of the overall question, we do have a basis in Jewish triage, for lack of a better term, for treating those who the community will benefit from before others. And of saying this person contributes more and therefore is going to get saved first, so to speak. How you make that assessment is not so simple and straightforward, but there is such a concept. Yes.
Case in point, just recently, this very wealthy entrepreneur who needed an organ back. And 20 people came to his rescue. And if you would need one like that for yourself, you would die for yourself.
Right. So there, it's a little bit different because people volunteered. Right? In other words, people came forward and said, we want Ottawa Senators tickets. Whatever they were expecting. But you're right, that certainly raised ethical questions, without a doubt. They're just not questions of triage within the community, they're questions of our personal judgment, and how we respond when somebody is in need. But go back to Diana's original point. Absolutely. This doesn't speak to the question of choosing one over the other, but it is meant to sort of shift the balance back a little bit and say, that doesn't mean that we will say, well, this person hit the age mark, therefore we're not admitting them to the ICU. Or this person is already at stage 4, therefore we're not admitting them to the ICU. And what this is saying is, that's not a valid means of assessment. If you want to say, the ICU is full of people who, we can do more for, that's a different story. But to simply say, I can't do a whole lot for them, therefore I'm not going to do anything for them, is what this disputes. Second point, though, goes back to the question that Alana asked. If I have begun treating the short-term patient, the one who may make it out, may make it through the day, somebody else comes into the unit, needs help now, and theoretically can be restored to long-term life, now what do I do? What would you say? Sorry?
I think it's the first one in.
First one in because?
I don't know. I heard it somewhere.
Well, Shira came to a class where I talked about this, so that could be where you heard it.
Maybe.
Yes?
If you're off on a timer for 2 hours and when the 2 hours run out, then you can reassess the dream.
Not necessarily. The old timer solution works for Shabbos. It has uses. It does have uses, and the obvious case is the Shari-Tzedek ventilator, you're right. But we need to look at this a little bit differently. If you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Feinstein was turned to with this question, and he wrote, "V'keivan she'hnisuhu l'hayachida l'rapposo." Once the patient has been brought into the unit for treatment, Kivar Zaha Bamakom, he has acquired the space. Not only if he's paying for his time in the unit, where you'll say he has, you know, acquired it in the sense that there's been a transaction, but even without that, even if he doesn't pay, it doesn't make a difference. What Rabbi Feinstein seems to be defining is what we call in law something along the lines of a relationship of care. There are different terms for it, but the idea that once you already accept responsibility for someone, you're not at liberty to walk away. So that what Rabbi Feinstein says is, he's yours. And when you think about it, what it is really fundamentally claiming is that that you'd be ending his life by taking this away. He's not exactly saying that, because if he was really saying that you'd be ending his life by taking it away, then I could use the timer solution. The timer, you know, hits zero. Now I'm not taking it away. It wasn't on anyway. But I don't think that's really what he's saying. I think he's talking more about the relationship of care that has been established. Take a look, please, at source number 13. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham deals with this as well. There are other sources that deal with it, too. I just brought a couple of them. Rav Wozner and Shevet Halevi in the sixth volume does it. He says, "Im harofei kvar hitchil tapel b'chole echad." If the doctor has already begun treating a patient, "Ochi bero tolemachshir," he hooked him up to equipment. "Ubachole sheni shezakuk l'tipul shel harofei lo somachshir," and then along comes another patient who needs that same treatment, who needs that same equipment. The doctor is not allowed to abandon this one in order to treat the other one. He's not allowed to take the equipment from one for the other. And he says, this is true, even though you don't know that you can save the first one. He says, that's what Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote. We do not push off one life for another. Even to save him or to save others doesn't make a difference. Interestingly, I now see where take a look at source number 14. This is what I had in mind when I was talking about what secular law recognizes. Judge Beverly McLaughlin, who I think now is the Chief Justice on the Supreme Court of Canada, so this was when she was not the Supreme Court, but she wrote, "The relationship of physician and patient can be conceptualized in a variety of ways. It can be viewed as a creature of contract, with the physician's failure to fulfill his or her obligations giving rise to an action for breach of contract. It undoubtedly gives rise to a duty of care, the breach of which constitutes the tort of negligence." So what she's saying is the same idea. Whether she would take it to the extremes that Jewish law does and say, therefore, even though this person has only half an hour, you can't take the equipment away, that I don't know. But it's the same concept. You have a duty of care for this one. You don't substitute this person out in order to use the equipment for somebody else. And so that's a second consideration. The first consideration, once we said there is a concept of rationing, the first consideration is to note we do value temporary life, And the second is to say, you don't have the ability to abandon somebody you are already treating. This doesn't address the case in which they both come to you simultaneously, but it addresses the case of a Rasuli. Rasuli is in the unit. He is receiving care. You say, well, there are other people I'd like to give the ventilator to. Rabbi Orbach, Rabbi Feinstein say, you have a duty of care. You don't have the right. He's still alive from a Jewish law perspective, and frankly, even from a secular perspective, he's alive. That wasn't the question. You don't have the right to take this away in order to give it to somebody else. And so that's the second point. The third and last point in this is the question of compelling interest, which is a concept both in Jewish law and in secular law. And what it says is, even if our basic legal principles lead to a certain conclusion, sometimes society has a compelling interest in going against the logic that you would have expected to use. Sometimes society actually benefits if we do the opposite of what we would have thought. And that exists in various areas of law. I'm going to give you an example from secular law in source number 15. This is from the Rules of Professional Conduct for the Law Society of Upper Canada. This is the 2000 edition, but the same thing exists in the updated 2014 edition. A lawyer cannot render effective professional service to the client unless there is full and unreserved communication between them. Okay, that sounds good. The client has to be able to trust the lawyer, to say that the lawyer won't divulge information. Well, one of the applications of this principle is the following law, and this is indeed what's supposed to happen. Let's pretend for a moment that I was a lawyer, right? I spent the last 45 minutes pretending I was a doctor, now I'm shifting gears. I am now a lawyer, and I have a client for whom I work in terms of real estate. He does real estate deals. He informs me, in the course of our conversations about the real estate deals, that he's also working on something else. It's an investment scheme. And it becomes clear to me, in the course of our conversations, that in fact what he's doing is a Ponzi scheme. I go home with this information in my head, and I see my neighbor outside watering her lawn. And I start talking to her, and she says, yeah, there's this great investment scheme that I want to get involved with, this fellow. And she names, sure enough, my client. And she talks about how wonderful the investment is, and she has this money that she just got as an inheritance. She's counting on it for retirement, and she's going to invest it with him because this is, you know, his rate of return is fantastic, and so on and so forth. Am I allowed to tell her? Nope. I am not. The rules of professional conduct set up by the Law Society of Upper Canada say that I'm only allowed to tell in the event of concern for death or serious bodily harm, which may include serious psychological harm. That's it. And even they are only allowed to. I'm not required to. But in this circumstance, I'm not allowed to say anything. I may be smart and come up with some other way to discourage it without telling her anything about this. I may say, you know, there's a better investment. It's this company called, you know, fill in the blank. I'm on tape. I don't want to mention the company and get in trouble. The fact is that even though I know there is someone who is going to get hurt, society has a compelling interest in making sure that people trust their lawyers. Because if they don't trust the lawyer to keep things confidential, they won't be honest with them. And if they won't be honest with them, the whole system of representation and the judicial system collapses. So therefore, we say, individuals may well suffer for the sake of society's compelling interest. That's one example. There are many more that you can give. I happen to like that example. But the same thing exists within Judaism. We have this idea of a compelling interest. We saw it in the beginning, choosing not to ransom a hostage, right? You know that if you don't ransom this hostage, they're going to be sold into slavery. Yes, but I have a compelling interest. I worry about what's going to happen if we ransom this one. 100 more are going to be taken captive. I'm not addressing the issue of prisoner exchanges now and so forth. That's a longer discussion that needs to be its own discussion. But my point is, we have precedent in Jewish law and in secular law for saying, you're right, this is what we should do, but it's a bad idea for society. And I would argue that the rationing policy has pitfalls for society. One pitfall is that it creates pressure on physicians as well as patients to seize treatment which is appropriate. We already see this with people who have been in the ICU for a while or have been in and out of the hospital for a while, and at a certain point they say, you know, I'm just a burden on my family and I wish it were over, and they feel guilty. Well, imagine if they now know that friends of theirs who have been in this position had in fact been told, we're going to take the equipment and use it for somebody younger. We have this policy of rationing. If they are going to receive the equipment, they're going to feel terrible. That's the pressure that it creates. This is not hypothetical. This is real. This happens. If you take a look at source number 16, Margaret Dorey, I believe I used this also in the session that we had back in February about Carter v. Canada and physician-assisted dying. She's a lawyer in either Washington State or Oregon, I forget, where they have physician-assisted dying. And she talks about her experience. She says, I've had two clients whose fathers signed up for the lethal dose. In the first case, one side of the family wanted the father to take the lethal dose, while the other did not. He spent the last months of his life caught in the middle and traumatized over whether or not he should kill himself. In the other case, it's not clear that administration of the lethal dose was voluntary. A man who was present told my client that his father refused to take the lethal dose when it was delivered. Quote, you're not killing me, I'm going to bed. But then took it the next night when he was high on alcohol. I'm not sure what happened in either case. We're getting one side of it as reported to a lawyer. But the point is that the pressure is very real. And the pressure that people feel is dangerous. We have a similar concern in Judaism for pressure in a very different area of Jewish law. When you're dealing with the issue of a get, if you take a look at source number 17, the get is a bill of divorce within Judaism. Take a look at this. Well, let me explain first one point that needs to be explained. There was an issue in Jewish law, going back to Talmudic times, regarding making sure that a get was delivered properly. And the reason why there was a concern is because there are certain requirements of a get that you'll never be able to tell by looking at it. Specifically, it has to be written with the particular woman in mind, meaning that you don't have the option. Imagine you have a scribe who has some time on his hands, and he says, let me just write some random ones and fill in some names, and, you know, we'll see if it'll be useful, and then I'll have it ready, and I can sell it at half price. It's already ready. So you can't do that. It has to be written with that person in mind. But you'll never know by looking at the get. So what's required is witnesses who will certify that it was done properly. And the concern was, well, what if it is delivered internationally? And so the witnesses aren't available to testify. And so you would require that the agent of delivery be properly trained so that they could testify that it was all done in the way that it ought to be done. So that's background on source number 17. Bar Hedya Boila Suya Gita, the fellow in Bar Hedya, who wants certification to transport the get. Asla kamed Rabbi Achi dava mamuna giti. He goes to Rabbi Achi, who's appointed in charge of getting these bills of divorce. Amarle, he said to him, Tzarech atalam arakol os va'os. He said, you have to stand there for the writing of each letter. Asla kamed Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi. Bar Hedya then goes to Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi. Amarle, lo tzrichas. They said, no, you don't have to be there for every letter. And if you're going to say, well, you know what, it's a good stringency, I will be strict. The result is that you're going to cause slander against the earlier gittin, which were not written by that standard. You're going to cause people to think that maybe the others aren't being done properly. That's the way it works in the Jewish world, right? Somebody adopts some kind of a stringency and says, I'm going to be super careful, and they tell their friends about it, and before you know it, you've started a rumor, yeah, the rabbi said you have to do this, which he never said, but somebody invented a stringency that just causes trouble. That's not always the case, but it happens. And so that's what they're concerned about here. If you're going to create this new standard, you're going to create problems for others. We don't like to create legal institutions which make life more difficult for people. It's a bad idea. And the same thing, this is my argument, in terms of the issue of rationing care, you're going to create pressure on people to relinquish care. That's the result of it. Because the lines are fuzzy. Do I deserve it? Do I not deserve it? Should I have it? Shouldn't I have it? These are really unclear things. And that's the concern. And then the other compelling interest that's involved is the need to create pressure for society to come up with better ways. Meaning, if we say in society that when a person reaches a certain age, that's the cutoff, 65, no more dialysis, you know, or whatever it is, fill in the blank. The result of that is that we give society an out. We've solved our problem. No longer do we have to worry about the shortage of dialysis machines. No longer do we need to invest more in this kind of care. No longer do we need to fund medical research. At this point, we've taken care of the problem. Nobody needs dialysis over the age of 65. So we've solved it, right? Think of a city in which they have a homeless problem, and so they decree, what we're going to do is put all the homeless people on a bus, and we'll take them out of town, take them to the next city, and we'll drop them off there. And we've solved our homeless crisis. There is no need to add anything into the budget. There's no need to work on minimum wage issues or whatever it is. Don't do that. I live there. The point is that we create an out for society. And from a Jewish standpoint, our job is supposed to be to try to find ways to mitigate problems, not to, you know, wave a magic wand and pretend that they've gone away. Right? We have within Judaism, lo samod al dam reyecha, do not stand by the blood of another. Kol Yisrael arevin zeh bazeh. We are all guarantors for each other. We're responsible for each other. That's the way that we normally look at it. And we can't say that we're simply going to look at, you know, the doctors and say, don't worry, these are really good people, and the policymakers in wherever they are that they're going to make the policy are good people, and therefore everything will work out all right. Because, you know what, it doesn't always work that way. And I brought just for interest the quote from Pope Francis in source number 18. In his statement of economic policy, and I know the Pope isn't an economist, and I'm not endorsing his economics, but take a look at his comments, because I think it has teeth. He says, some people continue to defend trickle-down theories which assume that economic growth, encouraged by a free market, will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system. Right? It's great to have that kind of faith in the system and think that it's going to work out that way and thinking that people are good people and therefore it'll all work, but it's a crude and naive trust. And I'm sorry, but I think the same thing is true when it comes to deciding that all the people who are determining how to ration are going to do everything in the best way possible. I think these are really hard things to do properly. And there are all sorts of different motivations that people have. And I will be very concerned about it being done properly. Our principle, generally speaking, is that we don't give up. And I bring you one last source on that point. Source number 19 is a classic. Kilo yechdal evyon mikerev haaretz, the verse says. The pauper will never cease from the midst of the land. Al kein anochim et savacha leimor, pasavach tiftach es yadcha, leachicha laniyecho levyoncha biartecha. So open up your hand to your brother, your pauper, the indigent person in your land. The fact that the pauper will never cease from the land is not a reason to give up hope and say, well, then I guess I won't give. Or I guess I'll cap what I'm giving. It's a reason to say, so open your hand and support. Whatever their need is, do your best to provide it. So to sum up what we've said, in a nutshell, going back from the beginning, we've said that, yes, the issue we're dealing with here is one of limited resources, which is economic / how many people can I save with what I have on hand. We've said that Jewish tradition does have a precedent for rationing. He saw it in terms of the way they rationed the resources of the community when it came to saving hostages. And we have a basis for saying, certainly when it comes to someone who can live a long time and someone who can only live a short while, we have a basis for saying, let's put the one who can live a long time first. But there are three factors which we have to take into consideration when making this kind of a calculation. And it doesn't mean we won't ration, but it means that we have to approach it with real care. Number one, there is always an imperative to care, even if you're not going to be able to heal the person permanently, so to speak. Number two, if I've begun treating this patient, from a Jewish ethics standpoint, I do not have the option of moving on to somebody else. And point number three, that we have to be careful in terms of figuring out what's really best for society. Is it best for me to create a system like this of rationing in which I create pressure on people because of the unclear lines involved in deciding who to save and how to save and how much to spend on them, create pressure on people to surrender care? And also, I take the pressure off of society to come up with better ways to manage these problems. So that would be those would be my caveats of concern. Questions? Yeah.
Let's say you had a pandemic that was going to overrun the resources of the community. What would be the ethical response if I was to treat nobody, to treat everybody ineffectively, to throw up your hands, to try and treat, I mean, even if you triage, the very young and the very old are not going to survive, so you have the bulk of the population in the middle, and no way to help all of them.
Right. So we discussed it a little bit in the session on Ebola last year. Which you have two out of three panelists present. When you're in a situation in which you need to do something, you need to act. And it's not a matter of developing long-term policy. It's a matter of what do I do right now? We're in a crisis. You may well end up needing to ration, but following the rules that we've set up, which is to say, we do our best to treat everybody, including the ones who don't have a prognosis of recovery, that we don't surrender the treatment of one for the sake of the other. We may well end up rationing based on value to the community and say, for example, use one example from that session, we're going to treat healthcare workers first because they're going to then be able to continue to help treat others, but also because society needs to, because otherwise people won't go into epidemic treatment. They're going to opt out because they're going to say, well, no one has my back if something happens to me as a result of me being on the front lines. So there are indeed rules that we would follow in terms of doing the triage, and we'd have to, realistically. Yeah. Yes, Alana?
My question is a little bit of an amplification of that. So that's like a one-off episode where there's a pandemic. But in terms of overall planning, right now, the percentage of taxes that's going to healthcare is
right. No, and this is a valid question. The problem is that it's even a more complicated question because you also have to ask yourself, what else are we spending our funds on? Meaning, do we cut from the arts, for example? In other words, it's not so much a question in the case you're describing of at what point do I cap it? What percentage do I cap it at? It's a question of, so do I save a few more lives, but then reduce what I'm giving to our schools? Or for our roads, or for everything else. So it's much more complicated than I'm going to answer right now. And I'm pretending that I actually had an answer, that it's just, I just need more time. Yeah. I'm going to need to go into Mincha, which is starting right now. But thank you very much.